Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week we're going to be talking about Star Trek Beyond, the third film in the JJ-verse. Just a quick reminder, I made some changes to my site and my show. Just a reminder that I'll always have the latest five or six episodes of the podcast for free. And I've put the rest of the shows on my site for 99 cents a pop. For the moment, they're on my website. I hope eventually at some point to get them on iTunes if I can. But just anyway, a quick reminder that some changes happened to the show. So J.J. Abrams was a producer, director, writer of the first two films. This one, he was only on board as a producer because he was focusing on, at the time, was gearing up to be Star Wars Episode VII, The Force Awakens. Writer Roberto Orci was set to replace him as director. But in May 2014, however, Orci's role was changed to producer only as well. Some of the directors considered were Edgar Wright. Jonathan Frakes expressed interest in directing as well. At the end of the year, Justin Lin was announced as the director. And Justin Lin, having done The Fast and the Furious, I think several films in that franchise, was the next director to go. In 2013, Roberto Orci had begun writing the script with two other writers, Patrick McKay and DJ Payne, with Payne saying of the script in March, quote, "We really wanted to get back to the sense of exploration and wonder, the kind of optimistic sense of the future that Star Trek has always kind of had at its core. It's the Chicago Bulls in space in terms of these people who are all awesome at their jobs," end quote. In January 2015, after Orci's departure, Simon Pegg and Doug Jung were hired to rewrite the screenplay, with Pegg saying on the previous draft, Paramount, quote, "had a script for Star Trek that really wasn't working for them. I think the studio was worried that it might have been a little too Star Trek-y," end quote. Pegg had been asked to make the new film more inclusive. I don't know if it was he or someone stated that the solution was to, quote, "make a Western or a thriller or a heist movie, then populate that with Star Trek characters so it's more inclusive to an audience that might be a little bit reticent to enter the Trek universe." So that was kind of the genesis of the movie. Almost of the cast came back, except Carol Marcus, who was introduced in Star Trek Into Darkness, did not come back. And Pegg said he did not bring her back because he didn't have a significant role for her. And we have a new villain in the person of Idris Elba of Luther and The Wire fame. So let's get to the film. So we open up with this now what has become a wonderfully familiar theme in these films. Great, great theme. In fact, and you know, these days, you know, filmmakers are doing kind of the Hans Zimmer thing where it's more about feeling and emotions and pieces rather than the old John Williams thing, which was born by melody. So it's nice to see that, you know, some franchises are still dabbling in having a theme song and a theme melody for the franchise. And this is a pretty good one. So the first thing we're open to is a mission where Kirk himself is performing a sort of ambassadorial duty to these two races, the Tinaxi and the Fibonians, and he's there on the Tinaxi planet offering himself as a neutral representative trying to broker some kind of treaty. And immediately I notice that the aliens all around, basically he's standing in the shallow bowl surrounded by these aliens, who look kind of like lions crossed with some kind of alien. And they were all very CGI. And I think with the Trek universe, I'm not used to CGI aliens. I'm really used to, you know, bipedal aliens, you know, what Crawl will be later on. Aliens with weird face makeup with a couple of antennas. So it just threw me a little bit to see CGI aliens in the Trek world. To me, that's more Star Wars and other franchises, but it didn't feel very Trek to me. It's interesting. So So we get a quick comment. This whole thing is played for farce in a way because the Tenaxi don't buy the peace treaty. They think that the Fabonians are stealing from them. And basically, Kirk is offering this thing, which will become later known as the Abronath, as an artifact that was taken, and it's offered in goodwill. And the Tenaxi think that the Fabonians stole it, and they're lying. So when we see all these lion-like aliens race down the bowl towards Kirk, we're frightened until they enter the same frame as Kirk, and we realize that they're only cat-sized. So, you know, in a sense, Kirk is being attacked by tribbles with fangs, in a way. And it's played for comedy, when Kirk gets kind of roughed up a little bit and then beamed out by Scotty. And we get the line when he walks off the pads, "I ripped my shirt again." And, of course, longtime original series Trek fans will know that the uniforms were of such poor quality back in the day that, you know, Kirk was constantly ripping his tunic for the most part. So now we're setting up the story, and we're getting a voiceover from Kirk. He's narrating it's the 966th day of the five-year mission, so about 3 years in, which was mentioned briefly in the beginning of Star Trek Into Darkness when Kirk and Spock were going towards Admiral Pike's quarters, Kirk not realizing he was going to have the ship taken from him, talking about how exciting they're going to pick a ship and a crew to go on this five-year mission. So we got a little seed of that in the previous film. And now we have a montage of the ship, and we see all our players there. We see Sulu with a small picture of his daughters on his console, which is kind of cool. One moment of Kirk getting out of the shower, opening his cupboard and his quarters, and we see, you know, the same uniform, one after the other, you know, and we're getting at this sort of humdrum existence that, you know, being out in deep space wasn't what he thought it was going to be. Part of the montage is Kirk being thrown out of the quarters of a young green-skinned alien female. I thought, like, we kind of did the green-skinned alien bit in the first film, so it just felt like kind of a retread for me. We also see that the artifact that they have on hand, which was rejected by the Tenaxians, is very visibly put into a cupboard or a storage area in some way. And it's shot in a way where we know, as astute viewers will know, like, okay, this thing's going to come into play a bit later on. So the main voiceover, you know, he's very bored at this point. We get a sense that, and I kind of like that they deal with this. This is some of, every once in a while, you get a little bit of the boredom of deep space, but Trek likes to keep things optimistic. And especially like Next Gen, when we got very science-oriented, they were psyched to be out there cataloging gaseous anomalies. Although sometimes, I think it was in Next Gen, where they were kind of making a joke of like, more gaseous anomalies. I think there are hints at this in previous incarnations. But I like that they deal with it here, that it, you know, it can be boring out there, just going from place to place, not much excitement happening. And in the midst of this, we see a beautiful shot of the Enterprise at warp, and it looks like it's in the midst of this three-dimensional, you know, long bubble. It's very cool, like a skipping stone. I've never seen the Enterprise shot this way while it was at warp. I was just very impressed by it. So now we get kind of a character setup scene and a theme setup scene. Supposedly, we have Kirk and McCoy in Kirk's quarters. It's Kirk's birthday. This scene is very similar in some ways to the beginning of Wrath of Khan with Kirk and McCoy celebrating his birthday. And damn it, Jim, why are we treating yours like a funeral? I don't want to be lectured bones, you know. So there's this funny throwaway line where McCoy had stolen some booze from Chekhov, and it turns out to be scotch and not vodka. And they have this little moment of like, yeah, I thought Chekhov were a vodka man, you know, which is ha-ha, right? And he's Russian. And we're getting the info that with this birthday, Kirk is officially a year older than his dad ever lived, because George Kirk, I guess, died when he was 30, saving the, I think it was the Kelvin back in the day. So Kirk's officially a year older, kind of has outlived his dad in a way. Scotty lays out what purports to be the theme of the film, which I don't really think makes it as the theme, because I think they abandon it kind of for a more action-adventure tone through most of it. But, you know, the theme is that Kirk has been trying to live up to his hero father from the minute he joined Starfleet. And at this point, now literally he's older than his dad, and it's kind of like time for him to start thinking about why he's out there, that he has lived up to, in a sense, his dad. And now it's his turn to decide who he wants to be without this overarching influence of his father on his shoulders, which is great. I mean, it's a great theme. If they're going to put it in the movie, it's a great theme. And this is a classic Star Trek theme about, you know, characters growing and moving through their world. And Kirk and Spock have these themes, and it's great. As I go through the movie, I don't really think they do much with it, but I will get to that as we narrate. So now they approach this deep space city called the Yorktown, and it is beautiful. I mean, I have a lot of problems with this movie in terms of character and story in a way, but some of the design in this city is astonishingly beautiful. And it's so cool in its design in that it's this massive globe city in space, but it's also designed with an idea that gravity doesn't have to be uniform inside. So you have these spindles, these large sort of spindles that are, you know, like rectangle in shape. And on each side of the spindle, the gravity is as if, it, you know, so it's like you walking around a block. And each time you make the turn to another side of the block, you still feel as if you're walking upright. And that's the flat plane, in a sense. So they do this with the construction of this city. And it's amazing. And the cool thing, too, is that the dock for starships is in the middle of the city. And they have to fly through these huge tubes that are open to space on one end, and then they connect with the actual docking on the other. So the ships fly into the city, and these tubes are partially translucent, so the people in the city can look up and see the ships coming in. And if you're on the ship, you can look out and see the Yorktown as you're flying into the main hub to dock, which is at the center of the city. And I thought, man, what a beautiful and clever design. It just was awesome. It's the kind of, you know, it would have been so easy to do just like a Star Wars based knockoff, you know, that we've seen before, or something that was just sort of like, you know, out of the cool sci-fi based playbook. But to me, this was really a triumph of design, and I was very impressed by it. And how Lin films inside, the camera really is very three-dimensional. It's all over the place. It's at all angles, looking at the ship, looking at the city, and you really get a sense of this thing being a city in space, not obeying a normal planetary sort of layout, which is awesome too. So we see some of the crew disembark, and we see briefly that Uhura and Spock have broken up. We're not exactly sure why, but there is mention of this necklace that Spock had given her that she wants to give back, and he says it's a gift, please keep it. Spock at that point is met by a contingent of other Vulcans, and they go off. And we see Sulu meet with his husband and his child. And I just thought, you know, in terms of same-sex marriage and the Trek universe, like the Trek universe is all about inclusion and diversity. And I love that they did this with Sulu. I just thought it was a great subtle touch. In a sense, Trek is a reflection in the future of the times that it was made, you know. Back in the day, having a Russian officer on board, back in the Cold War of the 60s, an African-American communications officer during the civil rights era, you know, and all that. That's all Trek. So now, you know, this version of it is like, you know, same-sex marriage is very much in our culture right now, is a big issue. And it's definitely part of what we are dealing with right now in our culture. And then it's reflected in Trek, I think, is very much to the spirit of the Trek ethos. So I really like that. We do find out that the Leonard Nimoy version of Spock has died. And so these Vulcans that met Spock on the, you know, on the landing give him that information. So now a little bit of an inciting event. A damaged escape pod comes to the Yorktown. This woman, alien woman named Kalara, is on it. And she is states that she was on a science mission inside this nebula and that her ship crash landed and she was able to escape in a pod. And, you know, now calling out for a ship to come into the nebula to help. So Kirk hears of it. He volunteers the Enterprise and he's speaking with Commodore Paris, who's the leader of Yorktown, or the ranking officer on Yorktown. And while he's speaking with Commodore Paris, we hear that Kirk has put in a request for a vice admiral position on the Yorktown, that he's willing to kind of step down from being a starship captain and kind of climb up the ladder. Very similar to what James Kirk did, the original universe, after the five-year mission, you know, becoming admiral. So there's a little harkens back to Khan in some ways here, the beginning of Khan, the birthday, the, you know, hanging up his spurs when he should be hopping galaxies kind of thing. The Commodore is very much kind of smiling and knowing that, in a sense, she's speaking to Kirk like, look, this is a place that all starship captains come to, and she's not really surprised by it, but she's like, why don't you give it some thought, and when you get back from this mission, we'll discuss it. Her kind of knowing, in a sense, that he's too young for this kind of thing and that he should be, I get a sense that, you know, that he's going to figure it out and stay out there, but he doesn't know that yet. And I like, in some sense, they reference space being a place where there's no reference. I think she says something like this, you know, when you're out there, there's no reference point. And it's very much, you know, if you, the very first Star Trek film, and a lot of this one, actually, when the space battles are filmed, you really do get the sense of a three-dimensional universe where there's really, you're not really given an up and down, left and right to hold on to. It's very all over the place because space really doesn't have those kinds of reference. I think in some ways it's a direct thematic thing of like, in a sense, Kirk is out in deep space with nothing to hold on to. He doesn't know what's up or what's down, what's left or what's right. No longer tethered to kind of this direction forward because of his father, he's kind of rudderless. So, it's there. I think I'm reaching for it, really, because I think after this, nothing much is kind of painted. I think they come back to it at the end of the film, and it's very pat. This theme doesn't drive Kirk's actions in any other way than that would make it meaningful than he would normally do as a starship captain. So to me, it's an odd theme of him trying to find himself, and how he finds himself, to me, it doesn't really work, but I'll get to that. There's a brief conversation between Kirk and Spock in the turbo lifts, and we get a sense that Spock wants to tell Kirk about something after the mission. We think as the audience now it's that, his older self has died. And if we're following in the footsteps of the other two movies, we gather that he may feel guilty in wanting to go to Vulcan to be with his people and, make babies, basically. And of course, Kirk wants, we gather, he's going to tell Spock that he's about to step down and become a vice admiral. And he's already told the Commodore that, that Spock would make a fantastic captain and he would be promoted in his place. But the dialogue is very flat, and actually, even in the earlier scene with McCoy and Kirk, in the two JJ films, the dialogue is so dynamic, man. It's funny, it's incisive, it does what it has to do, it's filmed with a wonderful rhythm. I mean, JJ comes from TV, so, I think dialogue is TV's métier. I mean, it's how TV lives and breathes with dialogue, really. So he's very good at it. Here, the lines just fall flat, and I don't get that sense of characters really interacting with each other more than saying lines at each other. It's just something that I feel personally that, Justin Lin's very comfortable doing these big, large set pieces like in Fast and the Furious, where there's not much character growth about anything. They all just run around and blow shit up. And here, he needs to kind of knit this movie together through character, and I'm not feeling it from this early on. So they reach the planet, I think it's Ultimid, something like that. And immediately they come upon this unknown large ship that's approaching. They find out that their communications are being jammed. And we see this massive ship disintegrate into like a million small ships, which is nothing we've seen before. The Enterprise has never fought a swarm of ships in this way, which is kind of neat. And somehow they're able to penetrate the shields and immediately shred the ship. And in short order, when Kirk tries to give the order to warp out of there, Scotty can't give it because then the cells are actually cut off. These things operate as sort of like liquid sandpaper in some ways, where they just kind of, they shred through certain parts of the ship, abrading it until it's completely cut through. And we see then the cells float away from the ship, which is something I've never seen before in a Trek film. So that's really cool that the nacelles get caught off right away. So now they're stuck there. Now we see that the little pods have more than one function, and the second function is to actually penetrate the hull of the Enterprise, open up, and disgorge fighters into the ship, so there's hand-to-hand fighting. So we see just that, and we start to get a lot of small arms action. There's the initial thrust of aliens is this led by this Lieutenant Manas, who's one of Krall's lieutenants. He has two, but the second one hasn't been revealed yet. They're sort of clearing a beachhead for Krall, and once they kind of wipe out the basic resistance of this one area on the Enterprise, he calls for Krall's ship, which then there's this brief moment where Krall's ship comes crashing in and he appears. And there was also one cool moment in the firefight where the Lieutenant Manas, he shot this gun at a bunch of the Trek fighters, and it went through like five or six of them in a row, killing them all at once. Pretty cool gun. I don't think we ever see it used again, but they have some kind of, more superior firepower than the Trek folks have with their phasers. Now Krall's ship breaches, and we get to see Krall in full reveal, and I really like Krall. He looks like a Trek villain, as I was talking about earlier, biped with a prosthetic face or head. Like, to me, that's a perfect Trek villain, or, a little blob that runs around, like the Horta kind of a blob. He just looks like a Trek villain should look to me, and it's very hard for me to describe even, but mostly biped with a goofy head, really, is kind of like what the main Trek villains are. They got that way because of budget limitations on and technology limitations on television in the 60s, obviously, but it's become to me a feel of there are certain aliens that the Trek comes in contact with that just kind of look a certain way. And this kind of harkened back to me, the original series Aliens. So they find right away, I guess they have some kind of sensor that knows where that artifact is located, and they go right for it and they take it. And Spock witnesses him taking this, and he radios Kirk about it via his communicator. And then we cut away, and McCoy, basically what's happening now is we're fracturing the crew. And this is the main mean of this fight, is our main core Trek crew is going to get separated throughout all this. So we start, McCoy comes upon this downed crew member and does a reading on him. And we could see that it looks almost like a mummified person. And so we're teased a little bit about this technology, which we'll discover later that Krall has tapped into. So at some point, you know, Kirk is now fighting hand-to-hand himself. He ambushes Krall and his guard, and it kind of devolves into a hand-to-hand fight between Krall and Kirk. And we see a reveal here that Krall knows of Kirk. Krall pretty much has Kirk at his mercy, and then Scotty does this thing where he reroutes power, and the shudder that happens to the ship because of it saves Kirk, and they separate. Him and Krall separate. Krall grabs the artifact still. The Enterprise now fully recovers, and it's headed for the nebula to try to get out of there. But the Krall swarm reach it, and they separate the saucer from the lower hull. And this was a little confusing to me as kind of a Trek nerd, because impulse power, to me, comes from the saucer section, you know, the sort of, you know, impulse slash rocket motors. They're reaction motors that are at the rear of the saucer section. So later on, I think they do this thing where Scotty had rerouted power for the impulse engines to run from the warp power. So I guess there was a rerouting of power, and they have to fix that later. And part of the fix is to cut that connection so the impulse engines can then run on their own without this extra connection. So I'm devolving into nerddom ridiculously right now, but hey, this is the Trek universe, and I'm allowed. So they separate the upper and lower hull, like, again, the sort of, you know, their liquid sandpaper effect. They're amazing effect shots, but I mean, this is par for the course, but it is beautifully shot in one way. There's just millions of moving parts that are happening in front of you. I'll get to a little bit why I don't really like it, but it is astonishing in some way. There's a lot of life pods ejecting now. Basically, all that's left of the Enterprise is the saucer section, and Kirk gives the order to abandon ship. So everyone does, and we start to see all the crew members, you know, hook into what they call these Kelvin pods. And as this is happening, Kirk sort of corners a head crab looking ensign, and she's got like there's this thing on the back of her head, which if you've played Half-Life, you know what a head crab is. She's like, "Ensign, I need your help," and we cut away, and it's a little seed for what's going to happen later. But so we see the rest of the crew, what's happening. Spock and McCoy steal an alien vessel and head for the service along with all the thousands of life pods. We hear from McCoy and from other crew members that Krall's forces are capturing the crew, not killing them. And then when there's one last fist fight between Krall and Kirk over the artifact, and as he's trying to separate the saucer, Uhura actually comes down and she kicks a little ass. And actually, she's the one who separates the saucer. During that time, Scotty is about to be captured, but he jumps into a torpedo, which he has rewired. He gets out. And then during the Kirk-Krall fight, at some point when Uhura finishes the sequence, Krall seemingly recovers the artifact. And at that moment, the saucer separates and Uhura is in the same section as Krall. They disengage and Kirk is on the other side and he disengages. So she becomes a captive from Krall. And there's a moment where Krall pulls the artifact case open and it's empty. So Kirk has pulled a fast one, as our captain is wont to do. And through most of this, I mean, the thing about just Justin Lin's style is like this, so much going on. And I've watched it several times now to try to see if it was just me being blown away in the theater. And it's a lot of this is very incoherent. The battle itself, what's happening, everything's being cut so quickly and happening so fast that I'm not following it very well. And even on the Enterprise, I don't really know where a lot of things are happening. They're just in certain areas and I don't quite know why and where they're there. So I have to say that during this opening sequence, I was very, very confused as to what was happening. And I was just holding on to what characters were doing and how they were getting off the ship. But in terms of knowing what was going on the screen and getting a sense that I was following something, I felt out of it. I really did. He was throwing everything but the kitchen sink at me on the screen, and it was so disorienting that I really didn't know what was happening. So I didn't like that. I mean, I'm someone who I get when you do a kind of quick edit section of a movie to throw the audience into unbalanced, but I don't like it for long periods of time because I don't like being unbalanced. I don't go to films to be affected in that way. I go to watch the screen and to feel that I have a command of what is happening there, not to be thrown out of it. So, but that's always my little nit when it comes to directors like Paul Greengrass, that they want you to feel something without necessarily being able to follow the action. I always like to follow the action on screen. And at the end, you know, when all of the pods are ejecting and Kirk is riding the saucer down as the captain is wont to do, you know, they hit us with this very sort of solemn and sad soundtrack cue, and I'm not feeling it. You know, it's trying to make me feel like it's this awesome, grandiose, terrible thing happening. But so much has happened, and so little character development has happened that I don't really feel it. I don't feel like the emotional underpinnings of how terrible this scene is in a weird way. It's like they got their ass handed to them. They did very little to fight to survive. They just got clocked. And I'm just not as involved. I'm kind of just, the movie's kind of doing its thing, but I don't feel so emotionally involved in terms of being afraid for my people to be safe. And I don't know, there's just something about it that feels very schematic, and that they're just kind of throwing this at me, and I'm following it, but I'm not emotionally engaged at this point in the movie.
This is the 24th century. Material needs no longer exist.
As lovely a dream as that is, which is why I love Trek so much, it is still the 21st century, and monetary needs are unfortunately still very much with us. And I just want to tell you briefly some ways you can support sci-fi on screen. One way is to subscribe to Patreon.com. And Patreon is very good for podcasters, because you can sign up with Patreon and you can choose to donate as little as a dollar per episode. And so every time I actually upload an episode, you would get debited. And you can change the amount whenever you like. You can stop whenever you like. So, you know, you're not just giving money indiscriminately per month or per week. Only when I put up a show do you contribute. There's also PayPal. If you want to do a one-time donation, you can go to PayPal, use scifionscreen@gmail.com email address, and you can donate from there. And non-monetary ways to support the podcast, please share the show on your Facebook page, retweet it, tell your friends, skywrite it, name a star after it, if you will. You know, do a review on iTunes, just kind of get the word out. And I have a dream someday of making this my sole source of income. And I think, you know, sometimes when I have several thousand downloads of a show, I thought, well, if every person who downloaded that show, you know, donated a dollar, I wouldn't have a day job. So just putting that in people's hats. And if you can't afford it, please just enjoy the show.
Gonna crack my knuckles and jump for joy. I got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
Now we're on the planet where most of the remainder of the film is going to take place. We start out with Scotty crashing his torpedo, ends up in a Hollywood dangle, as I like to call when our heroes are hanging at an impossible way with, you know, like four fingers on some rock face, right? And we have a landing sequence where all of the Kelvin pods are landing via parachute, so it's kind of like a World War II, you know, night paratroop scene. Kirk immediately suspects Kalara holds a weapon on her. She confesses now that they were lured there and that her ship was attacked. And that now what she says here is that, you know, Kroll told me that if I brought a ship here, he would free my crew. So, you know, there's this one layer of her betrayal here where Kirk could understand it being a commander, that he would do everything he could to, you know, sacrifice to get his crew out of harm's way. So at this moment, she's still kind of a good guy, but under duress. So then we cut to Kroll's base of operations. It's a camp of some kind. None of the locations on this planet are terribly interesting to me. They all look kind of like stock, and this camp is your basic refugee, you know, bad guy camp. I don't know. It's not that awesome. I mean, after I was dazzled with Yorktown, I'm kind of underwhelmed with a lot of the production design of this planet. We have a brief Kroll-Uhura conversation where Uhura is like, you know, Kirk's going to come for me, and Kroll, of course, is like, I'm counting on it, because he now knows that Kirk has the artifact and he needs it. Now we begin to kind of jump around a little bit in the story because people are split up. And we start with McCoy and Spock. Spock is hurt very badly. There's a piece of metal jammed right in his side. And so he's with McCoy. So, you know, there is some funny moments between these two as we go along, you know, when Spock is kind of at McCoy's mercy, and they're talking about just speech that McCoy uses that Spock will kind of question, like, why would you use that metaphor, Doctor? So that's a lot of fun of the two of them going back and forth. Scotty is by himself, and he's found first by two aliens, and then this woman who appears with a hologram generator who kicks their butts and wants salvage of whatever had crashed nearby. Her name is Jayla. And she's going to be sort of the alien protagonist of the film. We find out from J-Lo that there are many species all over the planet, all drawn by Kroll for some purpose. So, and J-Lo's okay. She has this striking makeup over her eyes, you know, these kind of lightning bolt-ish designs over her face, which are kind of cool. She's not terribly interesting as a character, I find, but whatever. You know, she finds out that he's an engineer. And she has a funny way of speaking, which is kind of cute, and wants Scotty to fix something, so she takes him prisoner. So then we do a lot of cutaways, a lot of cutbacks to different people. Kirk, Chekhov, and Kalara find the remains of the saucer. McCoy and Spock find a chamber which has matching markings like the artifact that Krall has, the Arbonath. I want to say Argonath from Lord of the Rings, but it's, I think it's the Arbonath. And Spock finally collapses. He's only gotten part of the way. Jayla takes Scotty back to her house, and actually her house is the interior of an old Federation starship, the USS Franklin, which has the dead designation as being the first Warp 4 ship, which is kind of cool. Kirk and Chekhov get to the downed saucer, and I guess what they want to do is use the scanning power of the, if it's still available, to scan the planet for the crew, which they know are being held captive. Back at Krall camp, Krall base, as it were, Sulu and Uhura get out of captivity and kind of wander around, and they find what they call a Magellan probe, and I think it's his Federation tech. And then at this station, they realize that Krall is hooked into the Yorktown's data net, and he has all this information about the Federation, and he knows about the ship and the people, and they get caught. So we've got that little information now that, you know, that Krall is a little bit more with it than they thought. We cut back to the Enterprise. Kirk and Kalara and Chekhov find the saucer. So Kirk finds the artifact case, and when Kalara feels he's about to take it, she knocks him away, and there's a second reveal that she's actually an agent, one of Krall's lieutenants, but she grabs the case that the Arbonath is supposed to be in. It's not in there, so Kirk kind of knew that he was onto her from the beginning. We don't quite know why. Chekhov even asks him why, and he just says, "I just knew." So they traced her. I think at some point they trace her comm contact. She must have gotten in contact with Krall at some point, and they traced it. And so there's a firefight here between her and her people that's very jokey and kind of fun. A lot of sliding around and whoa, you know. That just feels as weightless as this film does at this point. So we cut now to Krall and Uhura and Chekhov. You know, we're an hour into the film. We don't really know much here. There's not much story for us to hang on. We don't know what Krall really wants. They're really delaying that. We just know that he's a bad guy who's capturing people. So it just feels very underwritten at this point to me. We do find out Krall has the intentions to attack the Yorktown. But the back and forth between Krall and Uhura and Chekhov here is just, it's very banal. It's very cliched, bad guy, you know, back and forth. And of course, they're hiding who he really is and what he really wants, so they have to play coy with dialogue, which just makes it kind of boring. But near the end of this scene, he's hung up two crew members, and he does something to where he drains their life force, and we see whatever his head looks like, it kind of flickers and morphs into existence and out of existence. So something weird's going on, but we cut away, and we don't really know for sure. We cut back to Spock and McCoy, who are still on their own, and we get the backstory about why Uhura and Spock broke up. And Spock was conflicted about being with his people. He wasn't sure that his relationship with Uhura was ethically sound. And okay, I get it, you know, but it's not, in a sense, it makes perfect sense, but it's not engaging in terms of the movie. Because we're kind of told it rather than actually seeing it happen in action. I mean, all we saw was him refusing her giving back the pendant. So there's something extremely underwritten about that. I think it's all lip service. And for whatever reason, I don't buy it. Spock then tells McCoy that he's decided to leave Starfleet and he doesn't know how to tell everybody. He hasn't told Kirk yet. And there's some comedy here where McCoy says, "Well, you know me, I'd throw a party." And Spock actually laughs. So like, the camaraderie between Spock and McCoy is probably the brightest light in all of the stuff that's going on, because it is pretty funny. McCoy is deprecating in a way where we both know he's kidding, and kind of Spock does too. There's something about it that's kind of nice. But I mean, God, in this kind of nothing film, like it doesn't go very far, but it's very fun. It's back at Jayla's place. Her traps were set off. Before that, she's playing music, and it's Public Enemy, right? So we're back to the first film, having the, you know, the in our generation's rap music being played at the Trek's generation, setting us up for what's going to happen at the end of the film, which is very satisfying and fun. She has traps all around the Franklin, and they're set off by Kirk and Chekhov, who wind up being frozen in this kind of insta-foam that she has. And so they're all together now. So we've got Scotty, Jayla, Kirk, and Chekhov together at this point. We talk about the Franklin a little bit, that it went missing in the 2160s, and that the captain's name was Balthazar Edison. How it ended up here, there's a throwaway line in this moment of the film where someone says, how did it end up out here? And one of the answers, I think it's even from Scotty, where he's like, I don't know, it could have been captured by a giant green space hand, which I think was from an episode of the original series. So, you know, another little fob to diehard fans like me. The ship is not far from operational. Jail has been repairing it in an attempt to get off the planet. Now we see some video footage of the original crew. Nothing much startling yet that we see, but it's a seed to set something up for later. There's an old motorcycle there, which, you know, like, okay, it's Fast and Furious time is coming up. On top of the ship, she's been hiding it from Crawl by use of this camouflage because, you know, I guess her little thing is camo tech. You know, she has these 3D holograms that she throws, so that's, you know, kind of her thing that she knows how to do. They pick up McCoy's communicator briefly because McCoy and Spock are still out there. We cut back to McCoy and Spock now, and they've been spotted by Krall's people. So now we're in a race, but they're able to boost the signal from the Franklin. They can only pull them one at a time, so Spock vanishes first and then McCoy. So now they're all back together on the Franklin, and McCoy is able to repair Spock for the most part using the Franklin's medical implements, which he doesn't complain about. And this is always a classic McCoy, like, barbaric, you know, 20th century medicine. And I feel like there was a moment here where he could have bitched and moaned about the outdated instruments. He kind of does it in a way, but he doesn't really. And I just thought, all right, kind of like a lost McCoy moment. So back in Krall's camp, he comes into the main camp and he's going to start torturing crew members to find out where Kirk has hidden the Arbanath. And it's, to me, this happens a little too fast. He's about to torture Sulu in front of everyone. And then this crew member who sort of has a head crab head says, nope, I know where it is. And all of the kind of crab legs behind her open out, and Kirk had put the actual device in her, you know, in this part of her skull that opens and closes. So yeah, it's clever, a little moment, but it's kind of a quick, it plays really fast and there's no real drama to it. It's just like they threatened Sulu, she gave it up. So I don't know, it was kind of a flat scene. Of course, you know, he puts it in this larger device and so we see things clicking and whirring and churning and we know something's up, and then we cut away. So now they can't find, I guess for whatever reason, they can't find the crew. We have this little thing about the pendant now that Uhura was going to give back to Spock. Spock says is made of Vulkaya, which I guess is some metal you can only find on Vulcan. And then they can scan for Vulkaya because it probably is unknown on this planet. And if they find it, it's probably her. And then we have this refusal of Jayla to help them, which is just such a nothing scene because you know she's going to come and it's like, I won't go back there. It's horrible. These people, they killed my parents. And, you know, this one lieutenant who she's going to face off of actually killed her parents. It's supposed to be a scene between her and Scotty. Of course, Scotty convinces her, but the actress playing Jayla is not very good. And it's just kind of a dead scene because you know she's going. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, there's not much there. So then you have the MacGuffin scene where the artifact that he's been looking for back at Krall's base, he puts it into play. And inside this chamber, he leaves one crew member in like this chamber and he activates the artifact. And the crew member kind of dissolves into this black energy, tearing her apart. It's very unclear in what this device does, but we gather that it takes the life force of this person and it delivers it to Krall, allowing him to live for a long period of time. But it's not done very clearly, so it's a little frustrating. But so now we have our what I like to call the Fast and Furious set piece, because that's exactly what it is. They want to rescue the hostages. You know, rescuing hostages for Trek, it's like, oh God, could it be any more boring than a hostage rescue? You know, like, it's just... This is the part of the movie where you know they just designed kind of a stock action movie plot and then put Trek members in it because getting hostages, like, I don't know. Anyway, so the whole deal is that, you know, Kirk is going to create a diversion on this motorcycle while the rest of the crew sneak in and grab and beam out the prisoners. Jayla's got a sniper rifle, so from cover, she's covering Kirk. Spock, of course, is going to be after Uhura because it's his girlfriend. Ha ha. So they can beam 20 at a time to Franklin, which gives us a little drama clock here. Kirk comes into the scene, and it's Kirk, the hologram Kirk, so he's using her hologram generator. So half the time that they're after Kirk on the bike, it's not really him. They blow up a bunch of stuff. At some point, it's Jayla versus this guy who killed her family, and she's getting the best of it. Spock and Uhura finally beat off of all of her captors, and everything's happening. They're winning, and during all this, Krall bails out, and his lieutenant says, you know, finish what you started. Krall heads up into orbit, and then they have this finale where Jayla versus this lieutenant who killed her family. She's about to lose, and, you know, Kirk does a jump with this bike, and she jumps and grabs him, and they both spin around each other and are beamed out, which, you know, it's very Fast and Furious. I mean, frankly, all right. You know what I mean? Like, it's a Hollywood movie, so whatever. But I was, at that point, this whole motorcycle action thing, just, I don't know, I was really bored with it, frankly. So then there's a bit of a buildup to getting the Franklin off of the ground. It has to achieve some kind of escape velocity, so they're heading down towards the ground, and once it achieves this, you know, 88 miles per hour, Back to the Future, shall we? Up it comes in this very dramatic shot, and it's like, okay, we're on to the third act, which is the attack on the Yorktown. So the swarm emerges from a nebula, and the Yorktown takes notice. It starts to rally its defenses, but initially nothing works. There are crowd alerts. We're seeing shots inside the Yorktown. Initially, Spock and McCoy are going to beam into a swarm ship and try to find the frequencies to disrupt the swarm. The idea is that they all act in concert, like an insect swarm, and they must be communicating in some way, which allows them to stay connected. And so what they need to do is to disrupt their communications by using a certain signal. So this is the fun part, in a sense. They find that the signal is best carried by music, and it's going to be piggybacked on they call it VHF signal, and so they're going to broadcast over the comm system. And, you know, it's not Trek, but it's a lot of fun. They blast Sabotage by the Beastie Boys, and it starts exploding swarm ships like crazy. So basically, the Enterprise is just demolishing the entire swarm, and they have to get in the middle of the swarm for it to work. Crawl sees them, so he kind of backs on his own. He's going into the Yorktown to kind of bring this death-dealing device in and plug it in. He wants to basically kill everyone in the city. So basically, these broadcasts annihilate all of the swarm. At one point, there's a really cool shot where the Yorktown starts to broadcast as well, and all of the swarm that were close to the Yorktown just vaporize in this flash. Now, being a nitpicker, it's one thing to disrupt the signals between them so they can't operate, but they explode on impact immediately. So, I don't know. But, of course, it's just much more dramatically sound and much more satisfying to see the Enterprise cranking the Beastie Boys blowing up ships, right? So, whatevs. Again, we're back in Yorktown, which is just beautiful. Even the casual shots of it, it's such a joy to be in this set and in this creation. But at this point, you know, we're in a straight-up action film for the last two-thirds of it. We have this main chase in the open part of the city. The Enterprise is chasing Crawl. Crawl is in the city itself. The Enterprise is in one of those tubes that allow starships to get to the center of the city. So at one point, the Enterprise has to actually breach, and it breaches through water and raises up, and now it's like actually in the city itself, and finally gets in front of Crawl ship and stops it at the last second. It's a pretty bravura action sequence, really well shot, and being on the Yorktown, it really looks cool. And all three ships hit the Franklin saucer section as it surfaces and stops them all. And three ships have penetrated the Franklin, like earlier when they penetrated the Enterprise, and so they're now walking around the Franklin looking for survivors. But Crawl, of course, is still alive. He's made it, and it's at this point on the Franklin, Uhura sees an old video and recognizes Crawl as Balthazar Edison officer. Now we cut to him in kind of Edison guise, looking like Idris Elba, having stolen a Starfleet uniform, undetected now, walking unmolested in the Yorktown, moving amongst the civilians. Now we get the backstory of what I think is a really interesting, could have been an interesting idea, but it comes so late in the movie that it doesn't do much. I don't know. I feel like there's something about Crawl and Kirk thematically that should come to a head, but it only comes to a head at the very end, you know, where the frontier pushes back. Like, Crawl is sort of a version of Kirk gone bad. Like, he went out there too long, and yet he's not, right? Because we find out that he's a warrior and he's fought in all these battles, and then making the galaxy safe for the Federation, and then joined the Federation and was very frustrated with the Federation as this peacekeeping armada, thinking that life is war and struggle and conquest, and that's what makes being strong. So it's a really clever thing that they do. And we see a bunch of his video logs, and we see him slowly losing it as he crash lands on the planet. And we also hear that there's some technology that the indigenous life forms of the planet left that prolongs life. So, boy, I would have loved to have just gotten this early. I think I just wanted more of this in the movie than a little dump at the end, right before they fight and he dies. So, I don't know. It just felt weird to me. And then there's this last battle between Kirk and Crawler in the midst of this place where he wants to disperse the weapon in the air supply, killing everyone. And they, you know, they have the hero versus villain discussion about fighting the same battles. Just is so not interesting. And there's nothing thematically happening with Kirk here. Again, from the beginning of the film is, who is Kirk versus his father and what his arc is and what the theme of this film is. And at this point, frankly, I have no idea what the theme of the movie is. It's been one action sequence after another, nothing thematically knitted together in a way that makes me really care about any of it, you know. So very disappointing in that way. And we get this line from Kirk, better to die saving lives than to live taking them, whatever. That's another movie that no one made, so thud. And then a very action movie video game ending with all kinds of latches and switches that have to be thrown. Then at the last minute, the two of them being sucked out into this gravity thing, whatever. It's a classic last minute action. To me, these sequences in films are only as good as the care that has gone into the story before now. At this point in the story, these two fighting for, you know, the Yorktown's soul, I could care less. Of course, it ends with Balthazar Edison getting sucked out into space, and it's really Spock and Bones that save Kirk. I think with the alien ship, they somehow save him from being sucked out into space, but whatever. It doesn't, to me, it had absolutely no weight. I didn't really care at this point. I was dazzled here and there by the battle, but it had no emotional weight for me. You know, of course, as we were expecting, Kirk turns down the Vice Admiralty at Yorktown. Spock is opening the Ambassador Spock's personal effects, and we see a photograph of the original crew, probably circa Star Trek 2 or 3. Jayla has been inducted into Starfleet Academy, so she's going to go off and join the Federation. And they end up, you know, everything's going to stay the way it was. Spock and Uhura back together, no one really cares because we didn't really feel or know why they broke up. And we didn't see Spock go through anything. There was a little bit of Spock soul-searching with McCoy when they were together, you know, on the planet. But they were joking it up as much. So to me, there's nothing there. I don't think Spock learned anything about, you know, whether he's going to be with Uhura or be with the Vulcans during that time. So it's just, I don't know. It was all, to me, very slipshod. And at the end, they end up looking at yet another Enterprise being constructed. And we see 1701A. And of course, that was the Enterprise that was introduced with Star Trek The Motion Picture, right? Which was kind of up the ante from the Star Trek, from the Enterprise, from the series, the refit. So who knows, maybe if there's another one of these films, the Enterprise may look a bit different. And we're out. So, you know, not much to say except to that I was very disappointed in this movie. It was what I thought it was going to be. When I found out Justin Lin was directing, and really that Simon Pegg was writing the script, I just didn't get a sense that I was going to get a terrifically deep film. I got a sense that I would get a lot of action and a lot of comedy, and that's what I got. And nothing feels, you know, they tried to do the overlay of like the Star Trek theme of characters learning something or changing or confronting things, and I don't think any of it really felt earned or real. I think it was an overlay. The film just felt very lightweight to me, and you know, if you're not a big Trek fan, you probably liked it. You probably thought it was a lot of fun. If you're a Trek fan that has deep roots in the franchise, I don't think you liked it very much. To me, Trek is always about more, the deeper bonds between friends, the moral and ethical decisions of the missions. And I found most of these in the first two films. The second film was a little more action-adventure-y, but Kirk had a journey in that second film where he grew up. You know, the first film was really Spock's film to a great degree, but the second film was Kirk's in that, you know, he was this exactly what Pike pegged him as, where he, you know, he thinks he can get away with everything, that the rules don't apply. And at the end of the film, he's sacrificing himself to save his crew, literally dying to save them. And that's a huge arc for Kirk, becoming the Jim Kirk that now we know from the original series. And I thought that was great. I don't see any of that movement here for Spock or Kirk or any other character. I didn't see Kirk find himself here. He just, you know, it was an action-adventure movie. Kirk helped save the crew. I didn't see Spock go through any kind of real movement here either. And, you know, the rest of the cast, unfortunately for the side cast in Star Trek, like, they don't do much. They did a little bit for Sulu here, which is really cool. But, you know, at their best, they're comic relief and supporting or contrasting the main characters. So they were fine. But ultimately, I was really disappointed in Beyond. And again, I will reiterate this, that I'm very curious to see the upcoming Star Trek Discovery on CBS. I just feel like the Star Trek ethos is going to have a very tough fit in the 21st century because it's about so many things that are not really treated on in our dramas and in our sci-fi anymore. Our science fiction has become very action-oriented. It's not very dissimilar to, you know, kind of soap opera action TV shows that are not science fiction. It's very samey. The thing that Trek always had going for it was a little extra on its conscience and a little extra in its brain. And I did not find that in this film. My prediction, unfortunately, is that I don't think that's going to be found again. I think the Trek has had its golden era and that it's now going to be kind of an empty franchise going forward unless, you know, something happens at this CBS series. I hope, and I have the most hope, that it could happen on the small screen. but not the big screen. You know, when you're spending $250-$300 million, it's very hard to do a Trek themed thing, because you know, people who pay all that money don't want to alienate anybody. And unfortunately, when Trek's kind of an elevated intellectual thing, man, it's like the, you know, Trek deals with concepts that, you know, you have to stop eating your popcorn for a few minutes to listen to what's going on, and it's supposed to affect you. But those big, these big tentpole movies now that have to do so much and appeal to so many people, I don't know. I mean, there may be a writer out there who can do it, you know, and who can figure out a way to make it work. But I just see how difficult it is bringing what I love about Trek to the screen. And so I hope that somehow they can do it with Discovery on CBS. So anyway, that's all I've got to say about Star Trek Beyond. I will see you next time.